and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eliza Yurkov.
And I'm Danny Shy. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for news in depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. My name is Harper Mahood, and I recently had the opportunity to speak with Tobias Reed, the current Oregon State Treasurer and Democratic candidate in the race for Secretary of State. Reed was elected as treasurer in 2017 and previously represented Beaverton in the State House, where he served as House Majority Whip. We discuss the responsibilities of Oregon Secretary of State, Treasurer Reed's qualifications for the role, and much more. I'd just like to have you start with introducing yourself.
I'm Tobias Reed. I'm a state treasurer and candidate for Secretary of State.
You have been the state's treasurer since 2017, so you've witnessed a lot. You've seen pandemic, 2020 protests, and Oregon wildfires. How do you think that all of these experiences will inform your position?
I think I've learned a lot as state treasurer, and you're right, there have been a lot of things that have happened over 8 years. But while there are fundamental differences in the specific responsibilities that the Secretary of State has, in the end, just like state treasurer, the Secretary of State is an administrator who needs to lead a team of about the same size, about 200 people, and establish the right standards, ensure transparency and accountability, and really set the mission and the vision for an institution and agency like that. And I feel really comfortable doing that. There's sort of a thread between being a protector of financial resources and a protector of democracy. So I have, I think, a really good sense of what the office is going to need and be able to hit the ground running.
That leads me into a question I have about our previous Secretary of State, Shamia Fagan, who resigned in response to a scandal which revealed she had signed a lucrative contract with a cannabis chain while her office was auditing state regulations on cannabis businesses. How do you plan to reinstill voter trust in the midst of this scandal?
Well, I'm only going to have one job. I've done this as treasurer for the last 8 years. I have a clear sense of what I'm signing up for. I know the salary. I know how to make that work. And ultimately, I think people will be able to look at my record. You don't have to guess what it's like to have me as a statewide elected official. You've got almost 8 years of data. And while the specifics will change, the same approach is going to apply. I'm going to have the benefit of some of the same folks who have helped me as treasurer who will come with me if I'm lucky enough to win. And we're going to be really clear about our expectations. I want to treat everyone the same who interacts with the Secretary of State's office. The job of that office is to apply the rules fairly no matter who is involved, to hold up high standards for elections, to conduct audits that are based on data and risk, not on a political agenda or predetermined outcomes. And I think my record as a legislator and as treasurer really demonstrates that. And I'm looking forward to applying it as Secretary of State as well.
What are your biggest goals and what problems would you like to tackle if you're sworn in?
Well, I want to essentially bring to start a sense of stability and professionalism. While I've been treasurer, we've had four different secretaries of state, and I think the turnover and instability there has really distracted from the office's ability to do the work that Oregonians count on it for. So making sure that people are confident in our election systems. We have the highest voter turnout in the entire country in Oregon, and I think that's a result of really intentional work to make voting convenient, to make our elections secure and accessible and inclusive. But that's not something that can be taken for granted. And if we want to continue that, we've got to stay on the forefront. We've got to innovate. We've got to remove barriers and make sure that everyone who is eligible to vote is registered and is choosing to participate. I mentioned the audit function as well. I think Oregon's biggest problem is the gap between our good intentions on policy and our bad execution. And the audit function has a really important opportunity to try to narrow that gap by focusing on where we are getting the results we want for the dollars and the effort that we're inputting, and building an audit plan and an audit function that's focused on that, not on scoring political points, is a high priority for me. Finally, I think the corporation division, which is where every business in Oregon registers, can play a really important role in helping businesses to do their work and hire more people. Instead of having to chase information about rulemaking and regulations across different parts of state government, the Secretary of State's office can play an important role in helping businesses connect with those questions, so they can focus on how to build their business and hire people. But in the end, it's setting up that professionalism, that stability, those expectations, making sure that there is a team there that has the resources they need, that the legislature is willing to invest in the capacity that the office needs, and I'm looking forward to it.
In 2020, you lost the Democratic primary to our current governor, Tina Kotek. Any loss of this nature can be tough. What have you learned since then, and how have you grown in the 2 years past that experience?
It's a good question. I think I liked a lot about that campaign, other than the outcome. But I think the lesson is to be really clear and to build relationships and focus on performance. That's what I've done as treasurer, and it's certainly what I will do as Secretary of State. I'm running because this is a job that needs that stability and professionalism and that experience, and I think that's what I'm excited to bring.
Going back to sort of what you're talking about mail-in voting and the voting system and making sure that everyone that can is able to vote, this fall, the Oregon DMV mistakenly registered 306 non-citizens to vote. Your opponent, Dennis Linthicum, says he would seek to end Oregon's vote-by-mail system. What is your response to this, and how do you intend to improve Oregon's voting system?
I want to be clear. I am really frustrated by this outcome and the way it's been handled. But I think it's important to think of this question in a couple of different ways. One, let's be clear about what we're trying to accomplish. I think the aim of making sure that everyone who is eligible to vote is registered and is choosing to vote is a good thing. We're a stronger state when people are participating, when they're not on the sidelines. But what we have to ask after that is whether the policies and procedures that are headed in that direction are correct and appropriate, and whether the people who are doing that work are carrying out those policies correctly. And we know from the DMV's very own after-action review that we're falling short on both of those fronts, the policies and the execution. So I'm glad that the governor has begun an external review. I think that review needs to focus on both of those categories, the policies and procedures and the execution. And if they don't, that will be job number one for me as Secretary of State.
What about your background and experience separates you from other candidates who are running for this position?
Well, I'm the only one who has served in statewide office. I'm the only one who has not been barred from running for re-election to the state Senate because I walked away from the job. Senator Linthicum has done that. It's interesting, the way you put it, I appreciate it, because I think it's accurate. Senator Linthicum has sued to overturn mail-in voting. He took that all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. In various of our interactions, he has said he will follow the law, which I find very disingenuous given that he was a party to that lawsuit. He's also been unwilling to commit to certifying an election as Secretary of State if he didn't like the outcome. And I asked him over two different joint appearances, five different times, if Joe Biden won the election in 2020, and he's unwilling to answer that question. I think that's pretty core to the responsibilities of the Secretary of State's office. Conduct elections, oversee them, make sure that high standards are followed, and then you have to certify an election even if you don't like the outcome. His unwillingness to do that suggests to me that he's not qualified to be Secretary of State. And as I've mentioned, the key to any job like this, whether it's Treasurer or Secretary of State, is being the leader that sets the vision for a team, that makes sure that they have the resources, that is the public face, that talks to the legislature and the public. I've done that as treasurer for the last almost 8 years. Senator Linthicum has been in the Senate, where he's been making controversial statements and voting against things that I think Oregonians value. So there's a really big contrast in this race. In fact, I would suggest it might be the biggest contrast of any race in the entire country. So voters are going to get to choose, and I like where we are.
The Secretary of State in Oregon is a member of the State Land Board, which oversees land use in Oregon. In early 2017, when you were on the state's land use board, you voted to sell the Elliott State Forest, leading to calls and protests for you to rethink your position on the matter. While you ultimately voted to keep the forest in the public's domain, how can voters trust that you will continue to protect the state's forestry and ecology, as that's very important to Oregon?
Indeed. This is one of the advantages of a setting like this, because I can tell the full story about the Elliott, and it's a long one. It starts at statehood, when Oregon joined the United States in 1859, the federal government says to Oregon, well, you need some schools and you don't have any tax base. So you get the 5th and 25th section of each township for the purposes of supporting education. Over time, some of that land has been sold off. Some of it's been consolidated. So we have a common school fund, which includes $2.5 billion and a number of assets, which up until a few years ago included the Elliott State Forest. The way that worked was that forest had to be operated as a money-making enterprise for schools. Cut trees, sell the timber, support schools. That worked for a lot of years until the Elliott State Forest was determined to be, or discovered to be, the habitat for the coastal coho, the marbled murrelet, and the spotted owl. And suddenly the situation is reversed, and it's the school kids of Oregon who are subsidizing the forest rather than the reverse. But that constitutional obligation remains. So the land board that I was not yet a member of had to choose, how do we manage this resource and be consistent with our obligation to school kids? So the land board, that still did not include me, voted to sell the Elliott. And my first meeting as a state treasurer, I walk in, I'm now a fiduciary to the Common School Fund, which means I have to act in the interests of the fund and its beneficiaries, school kids, not my personal preferences or my politics, but I'm obligated to continue to make money for the Common School Fund and for kids. I walk in and the first question I'm asked is, will you vote to depart from this plan that the previous land board had enacted? And I didn't feel like I could do that as a fiduciary unless and until there was a viable alternative. So it's true, I did not support the move away from that because we didn't yet have an alternative plan. But all the while, I was working to develop an alternative plan. And ultimately, skipping over a very interesting winding path, that's where we are now. We have created the largest research forest in North America, which has met our obligation to the school kids of Oregon. We compensated the Common School Fund and severed the tie between the forest and the school fund. So the forest can now operate as a forest without the obligation and the urgency of delivering money every year to school kids. We've kept public ownership. We've kept conservation values. The world is beating a path to our door with researchers who want to understand how to practice sustainable forestry, how to build an industry that obviously has played a very central part in Oregon's history and is going to continue to do that. We have a role to play in the carbon markets there. This is something that Oregonians, I think, should be really proud of. And while it wasn't necessarily the exact design that I would have come up with or anybody else's, it's the definition of compromise. It's brought loggers next to conservationists, people who wouldn't talk to each other. And by making that space and asking different questions, I think we've really created a model that can apply to all kinds of challenging circumstances around Oregon. So as weird as it is to say, I'm the senior member of the land board as treasurer, and I hope I can continue that as Secretary of State to follow through on the Elliott and continue to try to bring those kinds of innovative and creative approaches to a range of challenges.
My final question for you is, what makes it special to be an Oregonian, and how do you wish to reflect that if you were to become Secretary of State?
Gosh, that's a challenging question. I think a version of that for me is that Oregon is in such an interesting place where we're big enough to matter and small enough to be agile and creative. And the role that I've gotten to play as treasurer has really given me the chance to think about long-run stuff, not just short-term things. That is the consistent theme for me as a legislator and as treasurer, now Secretary of State. I feel like so much of our policy and politics and our biology as humans really emphasizes the short term in a way that crowds out the long run. And I think when we realize our ability to collaborate and to be stronger together, then we're really going to be able to do big things. And Oregonians have such such good intentions, such aspirations. It's the follow-through where I think we are not where we want to be. And being Secretary of State, helping people to stay off of the sidelines, to vote and to participate and be engaged, combined with the authority of the Secretary of State as auditor to make sure that we're following through and getting the results we want is really exciting. So I can't wait.
That was Oregon Treasurer Tobias Reed, Democratic candidate in the race for Secretary of State. Reed is running against Republican nominee Dennis Linthicum and Pacific Green Party candidate Natalie Paravicini. Oregon ballots must be dropped off or postmarked by 8 p.m. on November 5th. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Harper Mahood.
Listening to KBOO News in Depth, I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined today by Laura Grimes, the Executive Director of Oregon Arts Watch, to get our local arts fix. Welcome, Laura.
Thanks for having me, Althea.
Yeah, thank you for being here. We're going to be discussing some of the latest reporting from your publication. And why don't we start with something coming up this weekend, the Portland Book Festival. What can folks look forward to there?
Yeah, the Portland Book Festival has been a mainstay in Portland for several years now. It was founded in 2005, originally known as Wordstock, and now it's run by Literary Arts and known as the Portland Book Festival. It's one of the largest festivals of its kind in the Pacific Northwest, and it has more than 250 volunteers that power this thing. More than 8,000 people attend. They basically kind of take over the park blocks down by the Portland Art Museum, but it spans like six different buildings, 10 stages. There are more than 80 authors people can come to see. It all happens on November 2nd on Saturday. And so there's a lot going on there. We have a lot of stories. There's a mini festival of children's authors at the Judy, which is the home of Northwest Children's Theater. And there are pop-up readings at the Portland Art Museum, which are always big favorites. It's always kind of fun to pair the artworks with the books. The curator always does a good job of combining authors and different interesting pairings that are always kind of fun to check out. So we have lots of stories, several of the authors who will be coming. We have this week, and we will have a couple of stories about the festival itself. So, oh gosh, we have a good at least seven stories running, and it's all coordinated by our incredible editor, Karen Pate, who doesn't give enough credit for all the work that she does.
So if you wanted to read about the Portland Book Festival, this is the spot.
We have a lot of coverage of it. We have a story that just ran this morning about Robert Samuels, who co-wrote a book. His name is George Floyd, which won a Pulitzer Prize and was a finalist for the National Book Award. David Saracen, who is a longtime editorial writer for the Oregonian, interviewed Samuels, and so he'll be coming to talk about his book. So that one should be really interesting. The book with his co-writer, who was also a reporter at the Washington Post, they interviewed more than 400 people to craft a portrait of George Floyd. So I think that will be an interesting book. And then we have several other authors featured. Yeah, so we have lots of stories about the festival coming up.
Well, Arts Watch also has a couple stories about Toni Pimble, who has led the Eugene Ballet for 46 years, and this season is her last one. What's important for folks to know about Toni?
I actually really love the stories about us because I didn't know a lot about the background about her work. She's led the Eugene Ballet for, this will be her last year, 46 years. And so this coming year will be a tribute to her remarkable career and legacy. She was a prolific choreographer. She choreographed more than 60 works. Her works have been performed all over the country, all over the world. And what I found what was interesting is the whole organic process of how they grew this Eugene Ballet. She and her husband, who was also a dancer, they danced together in Germany. And he was from Oregon, from Junction City, and he had trained at Eugene Ballet. So they came back here all those 46 years ago to take over Eugene Ballet. And in the beginning, they both managed it in tandem. They both did the administrative and the choreographic side of it. And then they kind of became more aware that he was better at the administrative side and she had a knack for choreography. What I loved about the story was just how they really didn't know how to run a nonprofit. They didn't know what a board was, and just the whole, how they really grew this company, just kind of figuring out their way. And because it's sort of a smaller city, that they could learn along the way. If something didn't work right, it wasn't a huge catastrophe. And they just took that in and learned from it. So I appreciated how the story really kind of tracked the whole remarkable rise of this company, how they grew it from just a small ballet company into a really highly respected, internationally respected ballet company. I enjoyed reading about that whole process. And what I will say, too, is that it's known everywhere that in the ballet world, a lot of the companies are run by men, but a lot of the dancers are women. And so it's remarkable that this company has had a woman artistic director all this time, and that Tony has also recognized that and nurtured talent from within the company to be able to take over for her when she leaves, and so it will continue to have women leaders. We are fortunate here in Portland also that we have several strong women leaders in charge of ballet companies, dance companies, and dance schools. Nancy Davis, the artistic director at the Portland Ballet, which is a dance academy. Sarah Slipper is the artistic director at Northwest Dance Project. And we have others as well. And so Tony is part of this cadre of strong women dance leaders, and that she recognizes that will carry that forward into the future. So this year on their list, they're going to do several of her full-length ballets, three of her full-length ballets. And then other performances will be a mix of some of her shorter works. So the whole season will be a tribute to her works.
I'm curious, what are some of the notable shows from her career?
Yeah, so the full-length ballets that they'll do this year, they're opening Mowgli this weekend, November 1st, which is based on Rudyard Kipling's The Jungle Book. It was initially debuted a couple of years ago, 2014 or something. And then they'll perform her Nutcracker in December and Carmen in February. So they'll also perform her new work this year, her new ballet, The Lark Ascending, which is inspired by larks that she liked to watch as a child when she was growing up in England. So I look forward to seeing all of her remarkable ballets that will be performed this year, and really pay tribute to her remarkable career and legacy.
Oregon Arts Watch also has coverage of a posthumous exhibit from John Montagu. This is a really interesting story. Can you tell us about it?
It is interesting. John was a really interesting man. He was a longtime software developer. He worked at Intel, and then he went and later founded a tech startup that was bought out by Mentor Graphics. And he has very quietly supported the arts for many years. He had a deep passion for contemporary music in particular, and also for visual art. He was married to Linda Hutchins, who is a noted artist here in Portland. She had also worked in Intel, where they met many years ago. And he's a very sort of gentle, kind, quiet, but a very patient person. And there's an exhibit coming up, which is fascinating. After he died in February. And after he died, his wife Linda found on his computer several videos and still shots taken from the same spot on the Willamette River for over 5 years, from about 2018 or 19 up until just before he got ill in December of 2023. And he took long walks along the Willamette Greenway, and he stopped at this one spot every time he walked there and took a photo and a short video. And it's a very sort of tightly cropped image where there is a decaying dock in the middle of it, like a frame within a frame. It's a square dock. And he just stopped there, framed that, and took it every day. And Linda saw the significance of that in just his sort of remarkable patience and whatever fascinated him about that. Nobody knew he was doing this. Linda didn't know he was doing this. And she has assembled all of this with the help of a filmmaker, has assembled a whole installation that is on view at the Nine Gallery right now. And so you can see the video show shot after shot that he took from the same spot, and the photo after photo, and so you can see sort of just in the details, the subtle changes. John had a real love for minimalist contemporary composers like Philip Glass and Steve Reich, and they're known for their repetitive nature. They very slowly modulate the tones, and you have to be just really patient and let the experience sort of let it happen. And so you can kind of see how these works, these images that John took every day, can reflect that, reflect his love for this music. So I'm curious to see this exhibit. It sounds fascinating, and it seems to me that it's sort of a labor of love that his widower Linda put this together, that reflects his patience and passion for recognizing the details and subtle changes that can happen in life.
There's a line from the article that struck me. Quote, Montague never sought exhibition for his photos and videos. For him, maybe the artistry came from the process rather than the product.
Yeah, I would say that probably so. He was a very kind of quiet, humble man, and I can't really see him looking for the limelight. And yet he very quietly supported this. He obviously had his own creative vision. It's somewhat fitting that throughout his life, he always enabled other artists to do their work. He always supported the work of other people and made it happen. And yet, he quietly nurtured his own creative passion that we can all be able to see now and appreciate.
Laura, I'm curious from you, are there things that you're looking forward to or that we should be looking forward to in the arts world in the coming month?
You know, something that I would mention right now, just because it's fitting, because Halloween is happening tomorrow, but KB Dixon has another photo essay of enjoyable Halloween displays that he's taken over the years. He has a sort of a, he's also another quiet man, but he has a very fanciful spirit for taking these photos, and they always kind of make me smile. So I will sort of maybe end on that nice little Halloween note.
If our listeners are interested in reading some of this reporting for themselves, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, so you can read all of this and more of our stories at orartswatch.org.
Thank you so much, Laura, for coming to talk with us on KBOO News in Depth.
Thank you, Althea. I appreciate it.
That was Laura Grimes, the executive director of Oregon Arts Watch, speaking with me about some of the latest stories from the publication. More information is online at orartswatch.org. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO's listeners value community, authenticity, and inclusion. If your business aligns with these values, underwriting on KBOO is an effective way to reach an engaged audience. Take advantage of the best rate and audience in